What is up, you beautiful people? Welcome back to the Built on Bitcoin podcast, where I try to talk to all the best Bitcoin builders, actually building cool stuff on top of Bitcoin. I am your host, Jacob Brown, and today I have a fantastic conversation with Lisa Nygut. You might know her as Nifty Nay on Twitter. She is the co-founder of Base58, the Bitcoin education platform, as well as the organizer of the BTC++ Bitcoin developer-focused conferences. And I had to get on the podcast after attending the BTC++ that was recently in Austin, Texas, which I had a fantastic time. I cannot recommend them highly enough, especially if you're a builder or you want to be like get the highest signal of where Bitcoin is going by the people actually creating those features and applications that we're all going to use in 6, 12, 18 months. So we cover a lot in this episode. She has a background as a developer in the Web 2 world and then moved over into mobile for a little bit before finally ending up on Bitcoin with somewhat of a focus on Lightning. So we talk about the education state of Bitcoin, like where are the biggest gaps, what's it like trying to learn Bitcoin compared to different languages, and the opportunity that exists because so few people really want to get in the weeds with Bitcoin. There's a severe lack of Bitcoin developers. And so if you apply yourself in a smaller niche, you can actually accelerate very fast to be proficient and useful in the state and be able to go and maybe apply for a company versus if you're going for, say, like something like a front-end engineer job. So I found that super interesting. We're talking about what she does over at Base58 to educate the masses and teach them proper Bitcoin fundamentals. We talk about women in tech, which is a topic that I care about as a VC, where I'm always trying to find the best founders, but you don't see many female founders. And so I was curious why she thought that is, and we kind of explore that topic a bit and a bunch of other topics. So I won't ramble on any further. Highly recommend. I think you're going to enjoy this one with Lisa Nygut, the co-founder of Base58 and BTC++.
Welcome to Built on Bitcoin.
Lisa, how are you today?
Hey, doing good, Jake.
Glad to have you on. Yeah, not sure where to start. I guess just a quick preamble. Like, we were talking before this, and I was telling you about, like, kind of my backstory of how I got into stacks and Bitcoin through, like, a roundabout way. And going to BTC++ was eye-opening for me because there's a whole community of, like, tight-knit Bitcoiners that I have not been a part of, was not aware of at all. And online, you know, stuff happens. We exchange words, whatever. But in person, everyone's always like, we're here to, you know, make Bitcoin flourish. So it was super great. First of all, great, amazing conference. Props to you. And you're a fantastic teacher. I took your little lightning, or it was like converting from hex to something or other. So that was great. Yeah, so I think this one will be interesting. This is more of like a caveat for my audience that like the bubble that we all exist in is not Bitcoin. And there's tons of dope people like in the broader sphere. So this is one that's exciting for me. I guess just to jump off, I'm gonna try with a different question. I don't usually ask this question, but whether it's Bitcoin or just something you read more generally, you know, I've been watching your replies on Twitter, and you have some like interesting topics about like John Vervaeke and like yin and yang and like efficiency and redundancy, like very interesting topics, things that I love. So just a like super broad, but what are you most fascinated by now, like right now by?
Yeah, that's a really great question. Okay, so like there's a couple, I think the like best way to like kind of understand myself is like I'm sort of like the big like intelligentsia nerd, right? Like I like just knowing about like all the like kind of cool interesting new philosophy things coming out wherever. Okay, my like current like obsession is that weird. It is like the thing that I can't stop thinking about and like wanting to do a lot of writing on is like just sort of like gender roles and like how like a values-based understanding of like how the life experience is different depending on what your gender is, which I like totally feel like is like a little taboo right now. I feel like depending on what like political circle you end up on. So I don't really talk about that like a lot. But it was kind of where like that yin yang sort of like comment comes from. Like the one that you saw about the yin yang thing.
Right.
It's like, it's just my brain is just kind of constantly thinking through that. And there's a lot of reasons for that. Like, I've been working in tech for over a decade. Tech is like a pretty masculine like field, right? It's like a very masculine energy field. Like a lot of the things that people get hyped and excited about, like, I guess it's like one of those things, I feel like a stranger in a strange land sometimes, if that makes sense. Like sometimes it's like, okay, I've like wandered into this ecosystem because I like really like information. And I really wanted to know like what, you know, what is like the computer thing about, like, and Bitcoin is like, what is that Bitcoin thing about, right? And sort of like a little bit like, I would say almost like the like fancy word for it, I think, is myopic, which means like short-sighted. Like I'm only really just looking at the things I'm interested in. So it's almost like, kind of like, I guess, like, is it like the, you know, when Elmer Fudd is like chasing like the rabbit around, like he'll have his nose on the ground, like following a thing. And then he ends up somewhere and he looks up and he's like, where the heck did I end up? You know, walked up a cliff or something, right? Like, so like, I feel like I've kind of just been following my own curiosity for like a long time and sort of like looked up and have been like, wait, there's like all these sort of like social dynamics going on. And like, why are other people here? I know I'm here because I got interested in this little rabbit hole thing, but like not everyone like has that story. Like, so why are people doing what they're doing in like the tech industry or the Bitcoin and the crypto industry? Like, what kind of like value systems mean? Like, what in this industry gets attention and gets money and gets like people really excited? Like, why is the hype around? What kind of like objects are those? What about those objects makes them exciting people? And like, how does that relate back to like their value system of like what they value, right? Okay, so that's like sort of very, I'm a very philosophical person, maybe is like the short way of saying that. And I kind of feel like some of that, to some extent, sometimes those hype cycles and stuff really do sort of start pulling back to these sort of like larger archetypes of like what gender roles are like interested in into and like how like maybe like, you know, gender roles are like sort of like a, there's sort of this like, I just had a long form blog post that I put out on this week where it's like sort of this rambling thing about like the standard contract of like negotiation between people who have different wants or like values, like buying and selling a house. So like this, okay, I'm like, I need to cut this off, but like buying and selling a house, you have like standard contracts in Texas. Like if you want to buy and sell a house in Texas and you're using a real estate agent, they have to use this like state approved like contract for buying and selling a house, right? Which makes sense. Like in New York State, by for like the counter example, in New York State, if you want to buy and sell a house, you hire an attorney and a real estate agent because they don't have like a standard contract. So that like adds so much extra expense and like difficulty in negotiating, like, you know, like buying and selling a house, you both want things, you both kind of want to end up with different things at the end of it. Anyway, so it's kind of just like, okay, how do we like, where do values come from? Maybe part of those values come from like your gendered experience, whatever that means. So like, what is the standard contract around gender? Or like, how does like your life experience as a particular like gender like change what gets focused in your life, sort of thing? Okay, that's my current philosophical like obsession.
We opened such a can of worms.
I know.
Also, that was such a good tangent, but I have to break this for a second because somehow I started the Zoom on the wrong account, so I had like the free timer ticking at me right now.
Okay.
So I'm going to end this real quick, get on my right account, and I'll send you the link on Twitter, and then we'll jump right back in. So hold the frame. We're gonna continue this with gender roles and whatnot. I'll be right back. Yeah. See if we can keep the energy. It's one of those days. Okay, so I might just keep that in there just so the flow feels more natural. So people just got to see what a professional podcast looked like. But you opened a crazy can of worms. So the general thing, I'm super fascinated by it for a bunch of reasons. My dad passed when I was younger, so I was raised by my mom, and I always felt more feminine energy compared to the average male. So to me, that was like, there's definitely a culture component, even when people say it's biological based. But when I started doing research, like the line between what's biology and what's nature is super hard to tell, especially in the weeds when it comes to like a bunch of topics. And they're trying to research on like, are women more submissive by nature? Is it culture? All these different topics. But one that it's like practical in tech and something I think about when I'm not doing this podcast, I work at a venture firm, is women in tech. Like, I don't see many women founders at all. And when I do see them, like, I have female coworkers, and they'll say jokes like, you know, this cohort's a sausage fest and stuff like that. And it's like tongue in cheek, but it speaks to something deeper, which is like, this doesn't have to be this way, or why is it this way? Right. So I'm curious of your take on the women in tech when you got here through just following the curiosity. So it's almost by happenstance, if you will. And so there's something else, which is like the, you know, the gender inclusion thing, which is like quotas. So there's like there's brackets here. Like you can over optimize. So what's your pulse on women in tech? Kind of like, I'm not really sure what question to ask, but you can just riff on like any thoughts you have on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it goes back to like, I think like part of the difficulty of being like a femme character, let's say that, in tech is that, like, these are my experience, like the things I care about and the things that I think are valuable, worth thinking about and like spending time on, and like how I sort of like process and move through the world is like just seems like a little different than like the people I'm like interacting with. And so like, I mean, like sometimes it's just as simple as like I just like it won't occur to me that like I should be like there's like other aspects of like what I could be working on or how I'm presenting myself that like might make what I'm working on more useful or more visible or more easy to understand to like other people in the room, right? Like, you know, like from like a why aren't there as many companies? And it could be like, you know, I think why aren't there as many organizations that get funded or like startups, you know, that are like founded by women? I think there's like two sides of that. Like, I think one side is like the people who are making the investment decisions, their values, I think they tend to be more men making decisions about how to allocate capital. And I think that like in general, their own value systems about what they think is important and where their hype is and what they think like is going to be a good investment, or like, you know, sometimes like making decisions about money and where to spend your time and energy isn't really like as rational as you would think it is. Like, you would think someone who holds money, like where they want their money to go would be the place that sends them back the most money, and that you would just like have all the opportunities and like impartially rank them all based on like returns, right? And then like you would pick the top three or whatever. Like, that's like how you think these things go. But my like understanding of humans is that that's not how we make decisions. A lot of really good ideas don't get funded. Doesn't matter who's running them, like guy or girl, right? And there's a lot more around like where people make decisions about how to invest like money, time, you know, resources, like money or time or like support even. Isn't necessarily like what's going to be the best return on that. Usually you kind of end up on like, what is the value of the person making the investment? And that's where I think it kind of goes to like, it's like, you know, maybe I'm not super excited about like, I'm just going to say it, like the security side of things, like keeping things super locked down or like protected. Like there's like almost like a protection side of things. I don't really like, I feel like at this point I've like sort of start tracking stereotypes to give specific examples, which is like,
when you say security, what do you mean in this context?
Yeah, I feel like, see, this is where I feel like it's like not dangerous that you start walking on thin ice, because people will be like, I don't like, that's not me, I don't like live up to that like value. But I guess like one example is like, I don't know, I feel like in general, I think you can kind of see men get way more interested and really understand the value of like protection and security and like having, I mean, that's, women also do this too, right? Like they want their houses to be like secure and like no one be able to get in and like attack them, or when they're out at night, they want to feel secure, right? But from like an investment perspective, I feel like, you know, if someone comes up with like a new way of making sure that like, I don't know, like your coins are like super protected or whatever, I feel like that sort of thing, like that sort of thinking around protection and how to protect, isn't like, not to say that women don't think that way, but I just feel like it's a thing that more men spend more time thinking about. Like, I've just seen this in, like, you know, I'm from Texas, so maybe this is like Texan for you also. So maybe I'm also speaking from like cultural upbringing, as you were saying, which, like, you know, the cultural thing, like, really what I'm trying to get at is values, right? Because I think values are how you, like, move people forward. And if you speak to someone's values, you can, like, figure out how to communicate with them in a way that, like, helps you both get kind of where you're going, like, kind of almost from, like, a sales perspective. So, like, in general, like, you know, all the guys in my family own guns. None of the women in my family do. Like, could I own a gun? Have I shot guns? Yeah. Is it something that I particularly think is important for me to own? Like, clearly not, right? So who's gonna, like, so if these, if my, you know, if my family goes to, like, a gun convention, who's likely to be spending their money there? You know what I mean? Like, it's like the values of where people spend their money kind of fall under what they value. And, like, I've seen, at least amongst, like, my family members, like, you know, the guys in my family value owning guns over and above the women in my family. So, like, if my brother and my dad were, like, VCs and they're investing in something that they, like, care about that follows their values, right? And you came up with, like, new kind of, like, 3D printed gun tech, for example, is, like, the project you're going to launch. Like, yeah, my brother and my dad would probably invest in that, right? The women in my family, probably not, right? Like, the rest of us are just going to be like, all right, I guess that's nice. Like, I don't care about it enough to give you money. And that's just, like, one example, right? So I guess, like, I'm saying, like, you know, like people invest and spend their money along where their values fall. I guess it's, like, an uncontroversial statement. The part that gets controversial is where you start being like, well, that classifying, like, this group of people tends to value this thing more because of XYZ reason. And I think then you start getting into, like, places where it's easier for people to be like, well, I'm not like that, therefore this, like, whole thing is incorrect. And I'm like, okay, like, maybe it's not true for you, but, like, and there's, like, general patterns you can kind of start picking out, right? And this is kind of where, like, earlier I was talking about that, like, idea of a gender contract. Like, I think the thing about, like, traditional gender roles is that, like, you think about, like, you know, the femme and masculine side of society for, like, generations now having, like, one, if you accept one that for, like, as long as humans have been around, the values of each of those sides of, like, humanity has, each of those different sides of humanity has had, like, a different things that they care about, like, as a value, sort of, like, generally speaking, right? And that over, like, you know, eons now, those two sides of humanity have had to figure out how to negotiate what they need from each other as, like, a way of working together in order to keep humanity moving forward, right? After, like, you know, like, eons of those sorts of interactions and, like, lots of different cultures, right? So, like, every culture, of course, will have different ways that they, like, what the standard contract they've kind of come up with as, like, a society, right? Because these are also, like, society level group, cultural, whatever we want to call culture things, right? But that was probably, like, a pretty standard understanding of how, like, those two, like, yin and yang sides, like, interact and negotiate getting their different value systems and having the different value systems be understood by, like, a party that doesn't natively have the experiences that help them understand where those values come from, right? Like, it's kind of like my, like, experiences and or my values to some extent come from what I experience, and my experiences and understanding of the world are just, like, slightly different. And so, like, you kind of need a way to, like, negotiate that. Anyway, so it's like there's, like, kind of the standard contract and, like, the way that we call it is gender roles. And I was like, okay, like, these standard contracts exist. Some places, like Texas, the standard contract, there's one and you must use it, you know, like, you know, in the real estate, like, ecosystem. If you want to do something different than the standard contract, that's fine. You just can't use the licensed realtor because the licensed realtors have to use the standard contract. So it's like, okay, you can go off script, so to speak, in any negotiation. That's allowed. But, like, you're probably going to have, like, way more conversation that you have to have around it. Like, it's probably useful to understand what's in the standard contract so you know, like, how you're different from it, you know, in terms of negotiation. Maybe you have to hire an attorney to, like, make sure that both parties are communicating, like, what they need and want so that you end up, like, getting all of your values met, whatever. Anyways, yeah, this is what I've been thinking about obsession-wise around, like, like, how
that has, yeah, No, this is great. I have some thoughts, and yeah, I think the gender norms one is big. There's definitely like a, most people aren't explicit when it comes to these ideas. Like, they won't say like, I don't hire women, or women are bad at XYZ thing. It's more of like, for the investor side, it's like, we need a founder to be a salesman for engineers, a salesman for fundraising, a salesman for talent, a salesman for getting users. And if you're not aware of your bias, you can write a woman off as not a good fit because of things like, say, she's not going to be aggressive enough to go out and get the whatever, or she can't sell to whatever. So that's like, in your mind, you think you're just making a rational decision, like she's not a good fit. But it could be a subconscious bias of your gender norms of like, men are good at this, women are naturally good at that, that kind of thing. And
you're,
I think
you're like basically like pitching to the standard contract, right? Like what the standard understanding is of like the trade-offs between like what genders, the genderishness of
something. Right. And and that's my question. That's my next question with like women in tech is that I think my thesis is gender norms come from one culture, obviously, but it comes from things being reinforced. So like you do some action and you either get punished or reinforced for it. And like one example you see with children's studies is like the words parents use, whether it's like outcome-based, like you did great versus like you put in a lot of effort. If you say the second one, it's more of an indicator of success because you're basically at something you can control, and it becomes the flywheel that effort leads to success, but it's the effort that's the thing, and the effort becomes the thing versus like if you get rewarded for that outcome, then you can cheat and still get the reward and you didn't actually do the real work. And so these like subtle word choice things become reinforcements that then become the norms. And it's so, okay, cool, I'm a protector because this, so I go learn to fight or I get a gun or whatever it is. So I'm curious, when it comes thinking through that framework of like reinforcement learning, if you will,
yeah,
is there something we could do practically, and it can do, maybe you can use it maybe for me as an investor or just society more broadly, to get more women in tech? Like, is there things that we can do practically?
I mean, I think it's just like valuing whatever it is in the like, okay, so we've just say like, let's just assume we can't escape the standard contract and that like, for whatever reason that like, let's just say that the general idea, like, you know, I'm just kind of like, and like, let's not be like super revolutionary. We're not going to change anything. Let's just like assume that status quo, right? Like, what can we do? How can we change our thinking about the way things are? Since that like maybe making an investment decision in a woman, like a project that a woman is leading, makes more sense because it fits some sort of like value recognition you're able to make. Like there's now some like value pattern matching you're able to make as an investor. Whereas before, like, okay, you're like trying to be like, okay, well, they don't have like the salesman-esque vibe that I usually find in like the male founders, right? Like as an example. I think probably one of the more powerful ways to like kind of not overcome that, but at least maybe start changing the way that you think about investing is by wanting to invest in whatever it is that like maybe is like the femme side of being a good salesman. So like maybe that just deciding that like whatever the femme values are, like the whatever like the values and like talents, that sounds weird, but like just like the general behaviors that like women tend to be good at pulling off. Being able to spot those in women, like women that are really good at those sorts of things, and then being like, okay, that's a good reason to invest in that person. So it's not like I'm trying to make them more into more of the salesman thing that I'm used to seeing in like the male founded side. It's like, what are the like skills and roles that you can like you see in women that you learn? I think it's just learning to value like the strengths that women bring that like are maybe outside of what you normally see in like a masculine candidate. So like a good example I think of this is like, so the Barbie movie, right? The Barbie movie is like arguably one of the biggest successes this summer in terms of blockbuster stuff, right? Like they're breaking $1 billion, right? Like they're basically, I think their budget was $300 million. They're like basically going to 3x that at least in like maybe, I don't know, opening weekend, but they're like doing awesome, right? It's a huge, amazing project. And so it's kind of just like, someone tweeted, and I thought it was really interesting, that like Margot Robbie is like the main star, right? But apparently she's also the woman that like pitched the project, found the funding for it, like put all the pieces together, like went and found Greta Gerwig to be the director. Like Margot Robbie, like actually was the coordinator, like kind of this conductor person behind the scenes that got all the right pieces in the right place to be able to like make the space available to like make the movie happen, right? And so like I kind of think like, I don't know, just one thing that I think I've seen women do that I haven't been seeing men do as well in like the same way is sort of like kind of making spaces for stuff to happen is like sort of, I think, like a really, what I would see is like definitely like maybe a little more. I mean, not to say that anyone can't do that. And I've definitely seen like anyone, you know, any, maybe this isn't like a men or a woman thing, but anyone who's able and has the skills of being able to like pull the right people together and kind of like make all the right people end up in the right room, like that's probably something worth investing in, right? Like whether that's like a guy or a girl, but maybe that's not like this marketing ability that's like easier to like read off of like someone that you meet, that sort of thing. So I think it's like really just like changing the perspective around as an investor, what you're looking for to put money into, like what kind of skill sets, like have you seen someone like pull out or like execute that you're like, oh, this person is good at like, you know, like Margot, like she's clearly really good at like putting all the right people together to like pull something off like that. But I don't know.
Got it. No, it's helpful. I like it. Changing your frame could be powerful. And I'll definitely have to ping you offline for like these fan values because I don't even know what that means. I have some intuitions, but I'll have to ask directly. But before we talk all day about this kind of like sociology kind of like topics, I want to take a hard left turn and move into the Bitcoin and Dev topic. So, So I think, let's see, where do I want to start? I guess let's jump into maybe briefly, what is your background?
Yeah, so my background is I started programming in my mid-20s. I did like a couple classes in college, but ended up going to this thing called Hacker School in New York City for 3 months in like my mid-20s, and then got a job working as an Android engineer for about half a decade. So I'm actually like a mobile phone engineer, like app writing for like 5 years before I found Bitcoin as like a thing. I'd always kind of been like cryptocurrency and distributed systems curious. Like I found that stuff really interesting, but like I just sort of needed like someone to like invite me to like spend time with it, if that makes sense. Like I needed someone to be like, okay, like this is your job now, Lisa, like figure out how Bitcoin works. And you're like, okay, great, like super excited about it, but it wasn't something I like knew or thought to like spend time investigating really closely on my own and getting involved in. Like I just kind of was like, I don't know if this is the thing I should spend time on. I don't know, that's hard to explain. So like my background was mobile dev development, and before I got into mobile dev, I did like some of my first jobs were doing a lot of like CSS kind of like front-endy things, and then I was like, I want to be a systems engineer and do distributed computing and like hardcore tech stuff. So that's kind of where I am now.
Got it. So it sounds like you went through a boot camp, which I've probably spent 200 hours at this point learning the code, mostly front end. Still terrible at coding. And you definitely hear online, like there's some people that love boot camps and some people that hate them. Like they just throw too much at too fast and they don't really try out good devs. But it sounds like your experience was like go into boot camp and then just kind of like followed your curiosity after the fact.
So like the boot camp I went to wasn't actually a boot camp. It was really like 3 months of work on whatever you want to and follow your own curiosity and work on your own projects. There weren't any classes. There weren't any teachers. There weren't any instruction. There weren't any like classes. Like it was all just like I had a project I was working on, which was an Android app already. So I was like self-taught mostly. And then like while I was in class, I like read some really good books. I did some like online classes. I did a really amazing like algorithms class from Tim Refgarden. Is like super famous in the Ethereum world now, which is really fun. I mostly self-taught, though like self-taught in the like aspect of like I didn't do like a formal coding program. I just kind of took some classes and like I'm big like you know, like, I think it's true to get into programming, you kind of do need a side project or something you're hacking on that's like, if you're new, especially like contributing to open source is like horrible and terrible as it is, like, it's horrible and terrible because like, there's like, I think it's a pretty kind of high-ish bar to like find a project, figure out how to get yourself set up. Like, if you don't know anything, how are you supposed to like figure out how to like be helpful and useful? But having like a side project, maybe one that is just like satisfying your own curiosity, even if it's like terrible, like hacker, like, you know, newbie beginning, like side project thing, that's like really useful, I think, for people to understand like what you're interested in, what you're like capable of, like kind of demonstrating that you like exist as a coder and like are putting stuff out into the world. So I had a couple projects I think that were pretty key throughout my career that were side projects I was hacking on for fun that were, I think, really game changers in terms of like opening doors for me. So like, yeah, like doing side project stuff like throughout your career is like kind of murder in terms of time, I think. Because like ideally you're like working a job and you have to go like work on a side project in your free time. Like, how does that work? But I think like for anyone who like really wants to like grow as a programmer and like really get other people to like invest in your growth as a programmer, but like hiring you to do jobs maybe you're not quite at the level to do yet, you know, because like grow into things, having little like side projects and like sort of portfolio that you can point at is like really important. Like, so like in order to get my Etsy job, I basically had to like write my, I wrote an Etsy app over like a weekend for my interview, and like it wasn't anything fancy, but it was like kind of cute and had some like interesting things in it, and like demonstrated I could like do certain things, right? And then when I went to the interview, I got to like show it off, and like, and that made like a really big difference in terms of opening the door for me that wouldn't have been there otherwise. Anyways, so
yeah, no, it makes sense. I mean, I could definitely see the value of having a side project. There's so many edge cases you're gonna have to like upload to this or SSH into whatever, or you have some weird issue or your package isn't updated or whatever it is, and you're forced in like an unstructured way to solve it. But definitely for me, the whenever I bump up against a wall, my default is to go back to the structure, like almost like a safe space where it's like, let me go back onto the track of getting to 100K, you know, this job, it's in the future, when right now I'm just like, my computer's yelling at me and it's not working and it's frustrating. So I don't know, it's a powerful frame. So I'm really just trying to put a pin in it of like the muck you're feeling, like that's what the work feels like. Cause it sounds like a lot of dead work is really that, especially when you're at the bleeding edge. Just like you have an issue, you bang your head against the wall, you make progress and repeat. Like, is that kind of the gist?
Yeah. So I mean, like, I feel like I started in my dev career late enough that I feel like I have a lot of like crystallized memories of like what all the different phases felt like, if that makes sense, and like what sort of opened doors as I like got better at it. So it's been slow. Like, teaching yourself is like not the fastest way to get to anything. Like, unfortunately, I don't think anyone can teach me anything. I think I'm one of those like extremely, like I'm super gifted in that like I can learn stuff really fast on my own and I can learn things by myself. But like the other side of that is like no one can tell me anything. But like anyways, like I think like what you're describing is like early in your career, it's like very frustrating because nothing that you try works. So like you can just waste so much time trying to like a thing you want to accomplish, right? Usually. And like it's like none of what you're trying, you're like don't understand what's, so like there's a lack of understanding of what the existing system is doing, and that makes it so frustrating because nothing, you're just like guessing it, like how do I make this thing do what I want it to do. Maybe that's like changing a DNS name so you can get your like website up on the right, whatever, or maybe that's like figuring out like all the like, and it's so complicated, there's all this complicated stuff around it that like only real experts really understand why it's there. And like, so you're like trying to navigate, like, I don't know, if you've done web dev stuff, like the thing that like I always like run up against, I'm like, how is any newbie supposed to figure this out? Is like the cross origin site stuff, like Tor's stuff, I feel like pops up, for like HTTPS, like TLS certs that like, you know, you're like, you've got this great little project and you just want to get it out there so people can see it. And then you start running into like all this like stuff that you don't want to have to learn to like get your project done, right? And it's like, man, like, why is this like I can do like X, Y, I can do like one little thing, but like programming sort of requires you to suddenly know, like, be an expert in like all this other stuff. And you're like, I just want to get my project out so people can see it. And like, you run into like, I guess it's like, there's just like pit everywhere of like not knowing how systems work. And so you constantly find yourself running up against new systems that you like don't have the mental bandwidth to want to figure out currently. Or like maybe you're in a system that you're still learning and it's that pitfall that you keep falling into that you kind of have to like figure out how to get help. Or like, it's like you don't even want to, like, you're just trying to get X thing done and you like keep running into all this stuff. Okay, I don't think that ever changes. But eventually, if you're in it for long enough, you start knowing where all the pitfalls are, what you can ignore, what you can't ignore, like how to get help. Like, and so working at a big company as an early engineer with like a big software team, it's like probably, so like working at Etsy is my first job, I think, was actually really great because it was sort of like a sort of safe little container that I could like learn and get really good at like the Android app stuff. But like whenever I ran into problems, I could like go find someone to help unstick the thing, right? So there were like lots of pitfalls, but there was an expert that was like attached to that like pitfall everywhere around me, right? So like when I ran into a problem, I could like, the person to help me out was like right there. And then like, so you kind of like have help, like you're not on your own in terms of trying to get the project out. So like side projects are good because they force you to like find pitfalls and like figure out what you're good at and what's hard. Being in a big or engineering organization, especially like I would say like junior early career, and you can convince them to hire you is really amazing because you get to, I feel like it really levels up like your exposure to like all the different things that could happen and what people like are good at, and makes you like faster in terms of like unsticking your own problems, if that makes sense. I don't know. Okay, I talked a lot around.
Got it. I mean, you're making my job very easy, so thank you for that. Also, it's funny that you say you learn quickly, but you can't be taught, but you're a great teacher. Like, that triangle was hilarious to me. But I'm curious about, so, like, I got here via wanting to become a dev, end up doing a podcast, now I work at VC, so weird path. But I remember the feeling when I started where I was like, I believe I can do it. I never really worked. I always loved tech. Never thought I could work in tech. It was like a self-limiting belief thing. And it wasn't until I got started that I started to see opportunities kind of pop up. But at least for me, like, I have to experience it first before I can have the confidence and like let it stack. And so I know there's so many people that listen to this that will tell me, like, I want to change careers. I want to work in Bitcoin more because it's XYZ. It's all I think about. And specifically for the dev experience, like, one that's really hard to grasp is the engineering mindset. Like, even something basic like how parameters get passed into functions, now they can call back on other things, it takes so long to grok before you can start like getting some speed. And I think newbies have the assumption that coding is hard, Bitcoin's extra hard. And I'm curious about, that's my question, is like, do you think that you can go from zero, and it's on your website, so clearly you agree, to go from zero to Titan hero? Like, is that true?
Yeah, this is a great question. Okay, so I think that if you get into, like, so basically eight, we've got, like, our first class. Like, the first class up until, like, literally 2 weeks ago, the only class you could take through ASAP is something that we're calling the Bitcoin Developer Basics. It's really like, it's a super hands-on class, which I love about it. One of my friends said it's like super, one of my friends is taking it, and then like another class that like someone else offers that kind of covers similar material. And he's like, it's very technical in terms of like, you're dealing with what I would call like very core aspects of computing, like bytes, how you write bytes. So you took my class on like how protocols work. Like, you have a number, you need a way to write it as bytes so the computer can have it in memory. You send the bytes to someone else, and then they like unpack it into like a number that humans can read, right? Like, that, like, that task is like very core to anything that computers do at like a low level, right? So that like simple task of like something a human can read translated into bytes and then untranslated. So like mine, the Bitcoin developers class really deals a lot with bytes, right? A lot of data. It's data and it's how it's encoded. Like how is it written such that like a computer can understand it? So I would say that that's like a very core aspect of understanding like the work that computers do. So like that's kind of like, I think like an underlying basic building block of the class. In class itself, like we don't really do a lot of programming. Like there's no loops, there's no function definitions. Like we use Python, but we use Python as like a calculator. Like I have some data and I need to turn it into like a hash. I need a hashing function. I need something that can make hashes. I give it data and it makes a hash, right? Turns out Python can do this in like one line, right? Like you don't have to write Python code to like do these things, but you just need like a little tool. It's like opening up your calculator on your computer, right? We just open up Python as our little calculator, like use it to calculate things. So like it's like, I think it's a developer basics class. Like we look at bytes, we look at data, we use some basic math, and we use Python as our calculator to like do the basic math. But like it's very like from the ground up, like first principles basics of like what is in a Bitcoin transaction. And I like to think that like, yeah, anyone can understand that. I think it's hard though, because everything is written in bytes and we're looking at bytes, and you have to like have this understanding that like bytes are data that you have to make like this translation between the byte format and the readable human format, right? But it's really like a data and like understanding like what is in like this like, you know, like form. Like you go to the DMV and you fill out a form. Like a Bitcoin transaction is literally just that. So like I think it's like, so yeah, okay. So like I do think, and I had someone who came through one of my Lightning classes. The first ever Lightning class was 2 weeks ago. So our first ever like not Bitcoin developer basics class happened 2 weeks ago in Nashville. We had 6 people come through. One of them just so happened, and I didn't know this until like halfway through the class, he starts telling us his story, which is that he had never done any programming before and signed up for our online 6-week basics, developer basics class, not knowing how to program. He got a lot of help from Cody and TA sessions to like be able to do the exercises. And he said it was really hard. And it's really hard because the level of stuff he has to learn is just higher than people already understand how bytes work and encodings work, right? Like you already understand that. It's an easier class, but if you don't understand that, you have to learn that, and then you have to learn everything else on top of it, like all the Bitcoin stuff. Anyway, so he had a lot to learn. He said he got through it. He did really well. He went back a few months later, he said, and he rewatched all the classes, which this is like pretty normal when you're learning new stuff. You like kind of have to revisit it a few months later. Like I have to do this too. Like I think this is like super normal. And he said the second time through it was really great. Just after that, he went and did like a boot camp. He said he didn't like the boot camp as much as the stuff because he's like, now I need to learn how to program. Like, this didn't teach me how to program. This taught me like Bitcoin. Now I know Bitcoin really well. I'm going to learn to program so I can actually do stuff with the Bitcoin knowledge, right? And then he did so well, he got the attention of like the Mutiny Wallet crew who like he was doing contributing to their like open source stuff. And so add the like, thank you, they got him a seat in the basic D8 Lightning class. How much do you need to know about programming to this D8 class? I think it's like not a lot, but we do a lot of computer level things, right? Like, I don't know.
So do you think, yeah, it's interesting because like in my dev journey, most of the stuff you use are like the higher level languages. So you don't actually even do much of like doing the hex conversion stuff that you were doing was like the very low level. That was my first time. I was like, whoa, this is crazy. Yeah. But it seems like that actually might be, it's a gift from the curse, but because most engineers don't have to go that low, if you start that low, it seems like maybe there's actually a benefit to being just Bitcoin and like learning that stack, because you can actually go from zero to productive or useful in the sense of like getting a grant or a job almost faster than if you like do the Codecademy and learn some of the basics and do that. Like, do you think that's directionally true?
I'm going to say yes, because I want it to be true. But I think there's a few times I've run into devs. Like, so I got my start kind of in the HTTP world, and then I spent a lot of time in like the Android, like mobile dev world before I got into Bitcoin. So like I've met people whose whole careers have been in Bitcoin and stuff. And I would say like,
they never had to spend time learning all that other stuff. So like, yeah, they like saved a bunch of time not having to learn all that like whatever like JavaScript stuff is. And they're able to like, yeah, go directly to making meaningful contributions, because like the truth is, Jake, like there's so few people that really understand it at the protocol level that like, honestly, I like anyone who goes through a base 58 class, like the basics class, and like, I think like really understands what's going on. Like if you're able to get through that, you'll be able to write your own Bitcoin scripts from scratch and like have a good understanding of what you're doing. How many people who already work in Bitcoin say that they know how to do that? It's like pretty few, I think. Like, I think I think that the basics are like actually pretty basic. The problem is that most people haven't had like good introduction to them. Like there just hasn't been really good like educational, like instructive materials to make it all make sense and make it seem like a thing that's really like accessible, right? But I think like the truth of it, I think it is like actually like it's accessible. You don't have to be a genius. It's hard. But if someone shows you like where the tools are and how all the little pieces like fit together, you can like learn the basics really, you can learn the basics really well. And then, yeah, when you go out in the world, like you'll know the basics better than like almost anyone. And all of a sudden you'll be able to like have good questions to ask in BitDevs, or like you'll be able to understand like what is an inscription doing? Like why are inscriptions so cool? Like where is like the witness data? You can like read inscription. Like you will be able to like read inscription scripts after you've gone through like the Bitcoin developer basics. Is like, okay, I'm not gonna promise that, but you should be able to. Like you should be able to go through the class on scripts. And this is just like the Udemy thing, just the class that we have in Udemy. And they should be able to go and look at an inscription script and be able to like know what tools to use to like inspect them, be able to like hopefully figure out what's going on inside that script, right? And then maybe even like write your own.
No, this is great. I'm hoping we at least attract one more new person to want to become a dev through this. It almost makes me want to shut this podcast down and just do this, because it's such a big opportunity. And I will say, like, if you're focusing on the 80-20, like the 20% of stuff is going to give me the 80, like learning the Bitcoin stack is going to super over-index. Just as you said, like there's not enough, and there's few people that do it at a high caliber. And from my side as a VC, like, the amount of money flowing into Bitcoin right now is insane, and it's still a lagging indicator. Like, money's being eyeballed right now. It's not really being deployed yet. And so a year from now, it's going to be pretty crazy, I think, from the stuff I'm hearing on back channels of how much funding, which is a big one for people's security, that will be on Bitcoin, which still feel, I think people still feel like it's like you got to go to Spiral and get a grant or something to like.
You. Sure. Yeah. But I feel like it's like if we could get more people into base 58 classes and just like through these like base 58 basics, like I feel like the like ideas people will be able to have and like the quality of projects that they'll be able to build and like contribute. So like you learn the basics and then you like pair that with whatever existing skills you have. Maybe that's like front end dev, maybe that's like I don't know, maybe you're coming from like sports betting. But now you like kind of understand like what's going on in DLC, is it makes you just like such a smarter like ability to like understand what people are doing already. Like I think it gives you a much better understanding as like maybe even as like a VC to like kind of, well, I can't talk to the, I don't really know how the VC thing works, but like in theory, like you get an idea of like what's going on and what these people are building, and like you're able to hopefully maybe find like a new interesting thing you can build because you have like these like ground level skills where you can just like take them in any direction you want, right? It's like it's not, you're not like pinned to like a, I'm not teaching you like how to build in like Rust or something, right? Like it's not, I'm not like fitting you just for like the Rust ecosystem or whatever. I'm like hopefully retooling people such that like the entire Bitcoin ecosystem is like available to them, hopefully. I love it.
Okay, I want to start. We've breezed through like almost an hour. This has been a fantastic conversation. I'm curious, where are the biggest needs right now that you see in the ecosystem across kind of like all the different layers, if you will, or different pockets that people can build in?
Yeah, this is a great question that like
it depends on who you're talking to. Maybe I should say the safe answer that's I don't really know. I don't feel like I've I've been sort of heads down and running around going to conferences and talking about education science, that the builder side, I'm really not sure. Just looking over at the ordinal side though. Okay. So I've been kind of looking into making it ordinals, maybe doing some stuff in the ordinals protocol system. So helping people figure out how to do more ordinal stuff. So I'm kind of just I don't know, looking at the existing infrastructure that's available in the ordinals ecosystem. Man, I don't know, just the number of people that really understand how that works seems really small. A lot of the stuff that I feel people are building over there, it's just not really robust in a way that's gonna make it easier to build cool stuff on top of it. I feel the infrastructure in ordinals is a huge, maybe I'm wrong, maybe the stacks people have figured other people have booted from stacks are solving this problem. But a lot of this stuff seems to be very closed source, so not super open source ethos. And then it feels Board as a project is needs more serious engineering effort on it. That sounds weird. And hopefully people are working on Ord, maybe they're doing a great job. I don't want to get in trouble for saying this. So whatever. But there's just some basic stuff. A simple example is when I run Ord as an indexer, maybe we're getting too much in the weeds of how Ord works, but when you're trying to inscribe an ordinal, if you're using the Ord tool, you every time you run Ord, it has to re-index all the blocks that have been happening since the last time. So as a user of this command line tool, and Ord is the only piece of software that numbers stats, right? There's no other piece of infrastructure tech that does a good job of indexing stats correctly, right? That's we all bow down to the Ord, what Ord says, right? It's the single source of truth. It's a very important piece of infrastructural technology for the whole ordinal inscription project, right? But when you try and use it as a tool, it's not, there's no way to keep it it's just really hard to use as a user. It's a piece of infrastructure that needs work. There's just things that could be done to it to make it such that it's a better platform as a piece of technology for other people to build on. And it's where are the people that are doing that kind of work coming from? Who's teaching people how to enough so that they feel confident doing that kind of work? Who's funding that? Who sees that as infrastructure worth investing in? And I think that is kind of, I mean, that's the true case again, I think, across the entire open source software infrastructure ecosystem, right? It's who's funding these basic tools that we all depend on? And it's where are the people coming from? If there's no money there, who's gonna work on it? Where are the smart engineers that are gonna be spending their time on it coming from?
No, it's a good point, because I'm very interested in ordinals, and there's so much application layer stuff being built right now, and some infra to make it easier to work at the application layer. But as far as I know, the team that builds on Ord Core, or whatever they call it, is super small. And so it's kind of the amount of interest on Lightning, at least Lightning Labs is building a robust lower layer, and they're trying to build out a good spec for Taproot assets, etc., so that then when you go and deploy XYZ thing at the application layer, there's a whole slew of team who've tested it, build it the right way, versus I could see it being, it's putting the cart before the horse, where it's build, get users, etc., and then it's but we forgot this one thing. And it's happened where it's there's an indexer error where it's off by one, which throws off a bunch of indexes stuff. And so it's like, do I have the millions inscription? Is the homie next to me have it? Who knows? So, and it becomes an ethical question, what do we do? And now you have cursed inscriptions. So they're counting backwards is how you solve the problem. So it's maybe going a little slower might have solved it, or maybe it's just the nature of building these kind of things. And
I think they've been creatively solving problems as they come up. I think that's like definitely a strength of that ecosystem. But I think getting funding and finding good people that have the curiosity and drive and consistency to be able to contribute to those infrastructure projects over the long term is hard, I think, right? That's sort of what Base 58 is hoping to get more people in the ecosystem. Maybe 100 people into the ecosystem, or at least get them through the class, right? And then maybe of that, half end up finding jobs or figuring out how to be in it long term. And maybe of that, 10 people are really the sort of person that really wants to do infrastructure level projects. So that's what they care about, right? But I think it's how do we get more people in? I don't know. Yeah.
Makes sense. Okay. I want to start to close this down. But one kind of I'll put out a call to action and just want to see a tee up BTC++ because there's something about doing things in person that is just way, way, way better. I like working from home. I don't have to travel and get stuck in traffic, but I also start to hate my home. And so there's you just miss people. And BTC++ as a very babyish dev was really cool to be able to be around people. I could choose my workshop. If I have a problem, the teacher can obviously help, but I don't have to break your attention. The person next to me probably already figured it out, so let me go rub some elbows with this person. So this is basically a call to action that if you're hearing this and you're loving everything you've heard so far, go to a BTC++ event. It sounds like you do it yearly at Austin, but you also have one coming up soon. Talk about BTC++ a little bit.
So we try Bitcoin++ as it's a dev conference built builders and learning dev educators, right? We care about people showing up who want to learn and participate and get an opportunity to the thing I'm trying to do with them is get people with cool, interesting projects there so they can tell everyone who's there about what they're doing and teach them about what they're thinking and working on, right? So that's one of the things we try and get in people that come talk and teach. And we also try and make sure that there's lots of opportunities for you to get to know people who are already working on projects, who wants help, who needs help, who's got ideas, that sort of thing, right? So we're really trying to get all the right people in the room. And then when you're there, the one in Austin, we kind of did something new this time where we basically did boot camp. It was an in-day, in-person boot camp. You had a cohort of buddies that you were going to all the same classes with, kind of going back to grade school, right, of for one day. The next day, we kind of turned you loose and we're here's all the different talks and technical talks that you can hang out and go figure out what you want to learn more about. Now you kind of have some grounding and you've touched it, right? So we try to make it super hands-on, super good for people who are both experienced as well as yourself, newer to the dev stuff, right? Where we're not assuming too much when you come. And then making sure that everyone gets their hands dirty while you're there, right? So they're we're trying to make them really in-person learning experiences and participating and building as much as they are come and meet and learn from people who's doing cool new projects, what's the latest and all up. So the one we did in Austin in April was all about layer two. So we had all kinds of interesting layer two protocol people there talking about their project. We had Paul Storr from the Drive Team guy there. We had a couple of roll-up people. We had Barack talked about ARC for the first time ever. It wasn't even called ARC then. His world premiere of the ARC protocol was at Bitcoin++ at the Layer 2 conference. We had the guy talking about Liquid, Bitcoin stuff. So it was really just supposed to be a showcase as well. So anyways, you should definitely come, especially if you want to just maybe you've been following along Bitcoin for a while and you just don't know how to get involved. Be take a Base 58 Bitcoin developers class on Udemy and just show up at the next Bitcoin++ and find some projects, meet some people, get your hands in the projects. We're doing one in Berlin, October 6th and 7th. This is going to be all about this project called Nix Bitcoin. So it's kind of more the DevOps side of projects. How do you set up a project? How are you, how do we get, if you've never used Nix before, hopefully this will be a really hands-on opportunity to try out using a Nix and developing software and deploying software using Nix. It's kind of a Docker competitor, sort of, but more fancy than that. So that's like that's the goal. Or if you like have a project, we're going to maybe hopefully teach you how to take your project and Nixify it so that you can deploy it on a Nix machine really easily. So just shortening that loop between developing software and getting it out like smoothly. How do we make deploying software and shipping software just like easier and using this like cool Nix thing? So that's in October, and hopefully there'll be lots of workshops. And the speaker lineup is incredible. We have some of like the best Nix people coming to like, and they're super excited about talking about Nix and teaching people how to use it. Cause like everyone who I know that touches Nix loves it. So like it's this like big fan, you know, it's kind of like the fan celebration. And then we're working on maybe doing a Buenos Aires Bitcoin Plus Plus at the end of February. I need to like kind of get the final details on that down, and like it would probably be in Buenos Aires last weekend in February, but that's like TBD. And then we just signed on, so like for Austin, if you want to come back to Austin, we just signed finalized the space, so we're going to be in Austin May 1st to 4th next year. So I still haven't put out like any, I need to send out like, you know, the early bird tickets and like start putting up some promo flyers for it. We just locked the space in last week. So this is like brand new alpha draw of like the next Bitcoin Plus Plus. But I think the theme, because I like picking themes because it's fun. I don't know. Who doesn't like a good theme? The one in Austin next year is going to be all about scripts, I think. So Bitcoin script. So we'll be hopefully talking all kinds of interesting covenants and like, I don't know, weird wild script projects that people are doing with Bitcoin.
Very cool. Okay. Yeah, I love it. Yeah, the thing that's really cool about the events too is like you see the familiar faces. You know, like, although it did shock me that like Taj, the like lightning creator guy, he was like, I'm like, dude, that guy's, you know who that is? That's that guy. And we're just like, he just treated like a regular dude. So it's just like a bunch of like minded people. But, you know, sit next to someone, you're like, this guy's just hacking away or whatever. And then, like, I'm sitting next to Paul from Mutiny. But I didn't know that. Like, I didn't talk to him really. I'm like, I don't want to disturb him. He looks very busy. He's doing something he's very involved in. So you never know who you're going to rub shoulders with. Like, it's super cool that all these different people who are building these super interesting things that you'll see announced on Twitter, then you put a face to it, and they're just, like, super down to earth, willing to help, all that. So yeah, I can't recommend it enough. It was a great experience. I love the hands-on. I hate courses for the most part that are too much theory and not enough hands-on. And day one was perfect for that. It's like, you can't leave without getting a Replit account. Where are you going? Give me your laptop. And then you're like doing some basic work. So that was great. So yeah, this has been a fantastic convo. Any closing thoughts or things that I didn't ask that you wanna tell the audience?
We're doing our first ever Bitcoin Plus, I'm sorry, Base 58 Taproot class. So, one thing I'm working on Base 58 is trying to get, I like a whole backlog of really awesome curriculum that I want to make available to people and start doing classes around. We're gonna start with it as in person, even though it's like kind of, I think, harder for people to get to and show up for. It's going to be, so we're pairing it up with the Tab Comp. So if you're going to Tab Comp, or if you haven't heard about Tab Comp, I'm going to be there. We're going to do a Base 58 protocol village. So there'll be like a whole like programming around protocols, what they are, how to use them. It'll be super hands-on, hopefully very educational. I love doing that kind of thing. And then before it, the Monday, so it starts kind of on like, I want to say, I think it starts like Wednesday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, I forget, before TabCon in Atlanta. We're going to be at the Atlanta Bit Lab, doing a Taproot, first ever Base 58 Taproot class. It's going to need some theory, but a lot of hands-on. Hopefully, we're going to learn about like what Taproot is, how TapScript works. You'll get to like do some programming examples, so like hands-on like exercises of actually building your first ever TapScripts, learning how to spend them. And we're also hopefully going to be doing Musing 2 and Frost signatures. So you'll get to learn like not only about how Taproot and TapScript works, but these two new, really kind of more advanced ways of doing multi-sig that work really well in Taproot. And so hopefully in 2 days, we'll be doing a lot of like hands-on, get to understand Taproot really, really well so that you can go out and, I don't know, build the next Taproot business, understand what the TapScript or Taproot assets, like how does that protocol work? Well, you'll like have enough understanding about what Taproot is doing that you'll be like a more informed consumer, hopefully, of any of the new Taproot like projects that come out. You'll get it. You'll be able to read it. Is the hope. So yeah, maybe check that out.
I love it. Yeah, I'm gonna try. I'm trying to find a way to get to TabCon. I definitely wanna hit that up. Yeah, if you're a newbie and you're hearing this, like, don't get concerned by all the words, Moosig, Frost, Nyx, all this stuff. Like, it'll come in time. You'll figure it out. We've already made the case, like, huge opportunity, and we need you. So please, go to Base 58, learn some stuff, and start building on Bitcoin. But yeah, Lisa, this has been a fantastic, fantastic conversation. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, Jake.
Thank you for listening this far into the episode. If you found it enjoyable, please do like, subscribe on whatever platform that you're listening on. YouTube does me a huge favor to like and subscribe. Find me on Twitter at Jake Blockchain. Show me some love. I reply to every DM. And if you are a Bitcoin builder that is kind of at the forefront of building new use cases, whether it's L1, Lightning, Stacks, Rootstock, Rollups, Ordinals, BRC20, I want to talk to you. So when I'm not doing this podcast, I am the sourcing partner at the Bitcoin Frontier Fund, where we invest in Bitcoin startups at the earliest stages, give you access to whatever you need, whether it's legal, product, fundraising help, as well as capital. So love to talk to you. You can hit me up. Again, find me on Twitter at Jake Blockchain, and shoot me a DM. I'll read everything. Love to talk to you guys. All right, peace.
Welcome to Built on Bitcoin.
I know that things don't always go your way, but I'll be right here waiting.
I've been waiting now. I've been trying to figure out a way to make it out. Make it out, because I don't think about it.